So now we can start today's Dhamma talk. As all systems go, very good. So today's Dhamma talk was going to be on insight, but I'm putting it in the context of the Anapanasati Sutta, because I stopped talking about Anapanasati yesterday when I gave the talks on the problems which one experiences in meditation and how to overcome those obstacles. But today I was going to continue on with part or stage 13, 14, 15 and 16 of Anapanasati. So Anapanasati is a complete practice in and of itself. You don't have to stop Anapanasati and then do insight meditation. Anyone who just reads the Anapanasati Sutta, number 118 of the Majjhima Nikaya, there you will see the Buddha stating categorically, and no one can argue with the Lord Buddha, that anyone who practices the 16 stages of the Anapanasati also fulfills the 4 Satipatthanas. At the same time, you don't have to switch for one or the other, just doing Anapanasati completes the 4 Satipatthanas. And anyone who completes the 4 Satipatthanas will also complete the 7 enlightenment factors, the Bojangas. And anyone who completes the 7 enlightenment factors will attain Arahatapala. So powerful, precise, and also it makes it that we don't have to compete. I do Satipatthana, I do Anapanasati, I'm better than you are. This is what you do next, this is what you do first. It's just an ordinary practice, even doing Anapanasati all the way is a complete practice all the way to Arahatapala, which makes life very simple, if you practice it. So, already the 12th stage of Anapanasati, I never truly tied in the jhanas with the 12th stage, but the 12th stage of Anapanasati is with mochayang chittang, freeing the mind, liberating the mind. But that word vimochayang is linked to the noun vimokha, and you should all know the vimokhas refer to the jhanas. So that 12th stage very clearly means the attainment, or rather the experience of the jhanas. So jhana fits as the 12th stage of Anapanasati. And the reason why it is important is that without the jhanas, number one, one hasn't got the data, the experience on which you can understand liberation. I always was struck with the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta statement that it's because not understanding the Four Noble Truths that people aren't enlightened. And I was struck on that because even as a lay person, I understood the Four Noble Truths. I could tell them to other people, yet I was not enlightened. So do you all understand the Four Noble Truths? So you must all be arahats. So the point was, it's not fully understanding them, especially the first one of dukkha. It's parinyatabang, to be completely, fully understood. So the reason why people aren't enlightened is they can understand 90% of dukkha, 99% of dukkha, 99.99999% of dukkha. But it's that last little bit which you haven't seen yet, which is what stops you being arahata. So, there must be something, some little bit of suffering we haven't truly seen. And that's the job of jhanas, to reveal that to you. To reveal that no matter how much you practice in the world, no matter how you try to improve yourself and improve the world, life is actually dukkha. And I'm giving away some of my secrets here, that sometimes when people claim to have seen the Four Noble Truths and become Arians, sometimes I ask them a simple question. If you are an Arahata, not yet achieved Parinirvana, how does it feel? Do you experience suffering, or are you permanently happy as an Arahata? And so many people, I'm so surprised and disappointed, say, oh no, once you're an Arahata, you're happy. And that's absolutely gomaya, not true. An Arahata experiences suffering, dukkha. And some people say, what are you talking about? All of that struggle, striving, keeping your precepts, and when you become enlightened, you're still suffering? I said, yes. And to confirm that, Bhikkhuni Wajira, and where is she? I said, it's in the, is that Samyutta? Oh, that's right, the Bhikkhuni Samyutta, if I'm correct. That's where Mara comes to see her. And Mara tries to convince her she's not in line. Who do you think you are, Bhikkhuni? And the Bhikkhuni says, all I am, what I experience, is dukkha arising and dukkha passing away. And that was a beautiful, wonderful snapshot, an interview of what it feels like to be an Arahata. Just dukkha arising, dukkha passing away, that's all, nothing else. And in the Theragata, you see the Arahatas in the time of the Buddha also describing their experiences. Like a workman who has finished the job but has not yet been paid. As a workman waiting for his wages. And when do those wages come? At Parinibbana. That is where suffering ends. So I'm not sure if you have been to those four holy places in India. I'm sure you have. But my favorite place, the most important place, is not where the Buddha was born. It was not even where he was enlightened, because a lot of people, they always worship that under the Mahabodhi tree as the most important shrine of Buddhism. But for me, is where he passed away, at Kusinara, because that's where suffering ended, at Kusinara. He just completed his job at Bodh Gaya. He just started the wheel of the Dharma rolling at Sarnath, but where suffering ended was at Kusinara. So, it's because people, there's still a little bit of suffering they don't see. But that is why they're not enlightened. And the powerful experiences of the jhanas, that gives you the data, the experience, on which you can work to find out what suffering truly is and how deep it goes. In the West, I sometimes explain it like an apple. Sometimes you get an apple, and when it's offered to you, there's some rotten bits in it, parts which are inedible. So what do you do with a knife? You take out the rotten bits, and the rest of it you can eat. But for samsara, you can't take out the rotten bits and enjoy the rest. The whole lot is rotten through and through. There's not a tiny bit which is not affected by the disease of dukkha. So you've got to throw the whole lot away. But number one, jhana gives you the data. And also it gives you the power to understand and penetrate that data. In particular, after you emerge from the jhanas, the five hindrances are disappeared. And I mentioned this is the Nalakapana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya again, where it says it's only with the jhanas are the five hindrances suppressed, together with nanda, that's delight, and tandi, this sluggishness of mind, for a long period of time. So this becomes your window of opportunity. You've just had these amazing experiences, and you have this powerful mindfulness, no sloth and torpor. That's why that very often if a person does enter the jhana when they emerge, you can't go to sleep at night. You've got too much energy. Not even the natural sleepiness is there when you go to bed. So if that happens to you, don't worry or get concerned. You can rest the body by just lying on your bed in a comfortable position, and you won't fall asleep. Don't try to meditate. Don't try to fall asleep. Just lay there at peace in the present moment. Hide your clock or alarm clock, because that just starts to pull you into the future. Oh, I haven't gone to sleep yet. Oh, how many more hours are there to go? Oh, I've got to give a talk later on. Oh, I'm going to be tired. That all comes from looking at the clock. So hide the clock and just lay there in the present moment, not worried about anything. This is natural. You're not going to die. You're not going to get sick. All those anxieties which mess with people's minds are not true or valid. So just enjoy just being peaceful and still. And if possible, just contemplate the Dharma, or rather let the Dharma come to you. Don't do anything. It's a time for rest. So you're resting the body, you're resting the mind, but you're perfectly awake. If you do something, start worrying, you just waste the opportunity and you get mentally tense. The job of this particular sleep, now after you've experienced the jhana that day, is just to rest the body, nothing more. So just rest, relax, and just do nothing. But you get heaps of energy. And that energy gives you the power of the mind to really look deeply into things. So you can see stuff which other people can't see in deep meditation, when you're really still. Or rather, after you've emerged from deep meditation. Now, somebody asked a question last night, which is relevant here. And it's something which does cause people a little bit of confusion. Because sometimes people say, no need to do jhanas, because in jhanas you can't get wisdom. And that is absolutely true. Jhanas are too still to get wisdom. But they are the cause for actually arising wisdom. They're not the arising of wisdom, but they are the necessary, indispensable cause for wisdom to arise. Inside the jhanas, no way you can get wisdom. But afterwards, you've got this incredible experience, this data, and then you have the powerful mindfulness in which to investigate that. And to investigate it, we use what is called Pachawekanayana. And for people in our modern world, I use a simile. It's the only simile which I've found which is helpful, even though it's far from perfect. This is people who've been in car accidents, who had a trauma. And when they go to sleep at night, sometimes they dream of that accident. Sometimes it flashes up in front of them. They can't get rid of that memory because that scars or leaves an indelible print in their mind. It is intense, but it's intense fear, intense anxiety. And that's why you can find a lot of difficulty forgetting it and pushing it out of the mind. The jhanas are similar in that they leave an indelible print in your mind. You can't forget them. It's just so powerful just like the trauma of a car accident, without all the negativity and fear. It's so simple, easy, just to point your mind in that direction and the experience comes up again. Powerful, clear, hard to forget, because these are intense experiences. And that means that it's after you emerge from the jhanas. Then, I can't imagine how anybody would not look back upon them and start to contemplate, what was that? Immense, powerful. Unfortunately, that many people do not have the information, the teachings, by which they can understand those experiences of jhanas. And that is the one reason why sometimes people have jhanas, people like Angulimala, and other people I've known, where they don't get Magapala. They have the jhanas, but they don't have the wherewithal to understand it. No, sorry, not Angulimala, Devadatta. Devadatta, thank you. Devadatta had the jhanas, but obviously did not have Magapala. Just was blind to the Dhamma. Had the means, but wasted them. And one of the examples, lay examples, when I was teaching a meditation retreat in Penang several years ago, the Dayakas, they asked me out of compassion, can I please spend 5 or 10 minutes interviewing this middle-aged lady who was not on the retreat, but who had some sort of experience which meant that she thought she'd gone mad. And she had seen psychologists and psychiatrists throughout Malaysia. No one could help her, and she was very, very distressed. And you know, I'm willing to do anything sometimes, have my photograph taken, do blessings of lottery shops, all sorts of stuff. Sometimes I should say no more, but it makes people happy, so I'm happy to help them. So I said yes, and she came into the interview room, and I asked her what happened, and she described an experience which was first jhana through and through and through. I recognized it. And again, there are some experiences in jhana which I don't tell you about, because that's, I want you to tell me, so that I know that you are not imagining this. You've even been there. Just like, for example, if you go to Paris on a holiday, you don't go on holidays, monk, suppose you go there to teach a Dhamma or teach a retreat or something. And you say, oh, I've been to Paris, there was an Eiffel Tower, there was an Arc de Triomphe, a Champs-Élysées. And you may have read that in a book or seen it on a video. So you ask them other questions, which you would only know if you've actually been there. And that tests whether you've actually been to Paris or not. So there's some other questions which I will ask, which will tell me that yes, you have been into jhanas, and you're not just faking it. And sometimes it's not intentionally faking it. Sometimes the mind is so tricky and sneaky, it wants the jhanas so much, it makes them up, it's not real. And if you're not used to jhanas, you can convince and confuse many people that they are real. So, there are some things in the jhanas which I will not tell you, but this lady started telling them to me. So, wow, you just had a jhana. And it was like a fluke. It was just luck. She wasn't much of a practitioner. She didn't really meditate that much. But she managed to, what I call, press that letting go button. Pressed it so well that just the jhana happened. I've come across many lay people who just fluked a jhana. Fluke means just by luck, by chance. And it's a true jhana. And once she understood that, she was so happy that she wasn't mad. She hadn't gone crazy. It was a natural experience, but quite rare. Incredibly rare when you haven't really practiced your meditation and come across the Buddha's teachings. But once I could put it in perspective for her, she went away one happy woman. Now, it is because many people can have an experience but don't understand how it fits in, that is sometimes why the enlightenment doesn't occur. But the jhanas are necessary. So, for those of you who are Buddhist monks and nuns and upasakas, upasikas, you have enough knowledge of the Dhamma. In fact, you have too much knowledge of the Dhamma. You know everything about what the Buddha taught. And honestly, when you look at the Buddha's teachings, and you see these monks, these nuns in the time of the Buddha, they did not have as much knowledge of the Dhamma as you had. They just have one sutta. Just one tiny sutta. And they go off meditating and become arahats. That was amazing. And sometimes it is my character to be a bit playful. So sometimes I repeat to my students the advice the Buddha gave to Bahiya. And there's a Bahiya here today, apparently. And the Buddha's advice to Bahiya, listen carefully, that in the scene, just the scene, nothing more. In the heard, just the heard, nothing more. In the sensed, which is the smell, the taste, the touch, just that, no more. And in the cognized, in the known, it's just the known, nothing else. And at that, Bahiya became arahat. You just heard the same. How many of you have now got arahatapala? And what was the difference there? And the difference was the power of the mind. You know, to actually have that clarity and that depth to see one of those teachings and for it to really ignite so the flame which gives rise to the Magapala. So, that is why I prefer teaching meditation than the Dhamma. You can read that for yourselves in the books. But, you have those teachings and you just emerge from a jhana. And you look back upon that jhana, you know, just clearly, wow, that was amazing. How do you look at that jhana? In terms of the first three of the last stages of Anapanasati. Stage, was it 13, 14 and 15? Anicca, Viraga, Nirodha. Get those clear first of all. And this is where that sometimes I get disappointed. That anicca, people always think that of those three characteristics, that anicca is the obvious one. That is the most difficult one. Because people assume they've understood it. But you have not. If you have, then you'd also be at least a so-on, if not further along the path. What have you missed in contemplating anicca? Because you've seen many things are impermanent, but there's some things you have not noticed are impermanent. Again, it is the nature of the mind. It only sees and notices things which change, which disappear. Just like the air around you. It's always here, so you don't really notice it. You can't smell it, you can't touch it, you see right through it, you don't know the air is here. But if the air was suddenly taken away, then you'd know. This is examples like the tadpole example. Only when things vanish do you realize what they were. And that is only things which disappear within the jhanas, and that's the only place they disappear. That's why they're necessary for you to understand, even that they exist, what they are, let alone that they're subject to ceasing totally, once and forever. I gave a simile that sometimes it's like we're sitting by a lake and we see the waves on the lake and we think that's anicca. Things rise and fall and rise again. And that lake means your mind. You see, thoughts come and thoughts go. Perceptions come and perceptions go. Sense objects come and go. And you really think that that is impermanence. But it's not the full deal. The full experience is when you're sitting by that lake, perfectly still. You see the waves rise and the waves fall. And sometimes it gets so still that the lake disappears. And the land and the hills around it also vanish. And the sky above disappears. Everything's gone. Things which aren't supposed to go, vanish. It's not just rise and fall. It's the whole lake disappearing. Where's that gone? I can't see it. Who took it? It's gone. It comes back again later on, unfortunately. But that is something you've never thought was possible before. All the other simile, which works much better for lay people. You're watching a TV. And that TV has many channels on it. It has 5 channels. Seeing channel, hearing channel, smell, taste and touch channel. And you go from one to the other, one to the other, one to the other. And they rise and fall, they rise and fall. You know, I think it's like surfing, is it surfing the channels they call it? But then, those 5 channels turn off, and you got the mind channel, which I call like the screen, when everything else is turned off. I go to many hotels, and in every hotel, sometimes, you know, in these 5-star hotels, they have a TV in the bathroom. I've been in one of these hotels in Singapore, a special TV which is waterproof. And you can sit in the bar and watch the TV. Special TV. And even got a remote control which is waterproof. It's absolutely crazy. But then people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, when you're in a hotel room, do you watch the TV? And I say, yes. I look at the TV. I encourage you to look at the TV. But don't turn it on. It's much more quiet. And if you look at the TV, if you look very carefully, you can see a reflection of yourself there. That's Dhamma. It's only when there's no channels active on the TV can you see your reflection in the glass screen. You see, it's beautiful similes. If you turn it on, the 5 senses are happening, you can't see the one who's watching. But, so the 5 senses disappear. And you got just the one who's watching. But then, that's not enough anicca. Then, the television vanishes. It's not there anymore. And that's very dangerous if you're in a hotel room, because they'll charge that on your account. TV has vanished. Well, that's only a simile. But, that's what happens. The one who's watching has gone too. There are some things which you haven't seen as anicca. And this, I'll tell you the 2 big ones already. I told you one already, the will and the knower. And to this day, there's some very senior monks, even of my own tradition, before they excommunicated me for ordaining bhikkhunis, even some of those, just in total ignorance of the teachings of the Buddha, say that after Parinirvana there is a knower, a basic consciousness, a ground of all being, an original mind, which survives after Parinirvana. That is absolute gomayang and dangerous gomayang too. The reason is because it's very attractive. Yes, I'm enlightened, believe I can enjoy my life after Parinirvana. What's the point, they say, of getting enlightened if you can't enjoy it afterwards? It's like working so hard, and as soon as you get paid, you have to throw the money away. Oh, can't I at least enjoy my Parinirvana? No. So, and this is where, because this part you haven't seen is anicca, you haven't seen it vanishing, you haven't experienced that. So because you haven't experienced it, number one, you don't even know it exists. It's always been there, like the TV set, like the lake. You can't imagine it just vanishing. It's totally beyond what you think is possible. That's why the jhanas are shocking. Wow, this is not like anything I've seen before. Things are anicca. Things which you never really knew existed before. Now they're gone, and you know they were there. That was what you held on to. You monks will probably appreciate, I've already mentioned this assembly before, but you'll appreciate it, how difficult it is when you become a monk or a nun. You know, you have to give up so much. I became a monk 23 years of age, fit, healthy, handsome, lots of girlfriends. Had to give them all away. So I gave up romance and sex. That was really difficult, but I was inspired. And as soon as I gave that up, I started getting attached to food. Food was really, and it's amazing, even though it was disgusting food, still you get attached to it. And so, a long time I had to give that up, don't eat so much, stop it. And as soon as I gave that up, something else came up which I got attached to. And that's why I said the symbol of the hand, you keep picking things up. And I thought, how can I let go of everything? And that's why I came across the symbol of the hand, which I'm now elaborating on now. If you have a hand, that's just what it does. That's its function. You cannot stop your hand picking things up. So, the only solution is cut off the hand. If I don't have a hand, then I can't pick things up. Solution. And that was my simile for just the nature of this mind and will. As long as it's there, it'll always attach to stuff. That's its nature. You can't control that. Just like you can't stop the dog from barking. That's their nature. So, we have to cut hand off. That's non-self. When you haven't got a self, a me, a mine, only then will you stop attaching to things. There's nothing to attach. It's like the hand. Grasping has two ends to it. The far end, what you pick up, and what does the picking up? And too often in my life as a monk, I was always focusing on what I'm picking up, instead of looking at what's doing the picking up. That was a sense of self, me, mine. And of course the Buddha said that very clearly, but I was too dumb to understand. Or some of the teachings my master Ajahn Chah gave, oh, they were so accurate, but I didn't understand them. I was too dumb at the time. But don't worry. Because it's an amazing thing which I've noticed over 42 years of practice. All those teachings which Ajahn Chah gave me, which I did not understand, which I thought was crazy, which I thought was not in line with the Buddha's teachings, I remembered. Don't know how, But later on in my monastic life, you get a meditative experience, you get an insight, and suddenly you, wow, that was Ajahn Chah. He told me that. Your mind is very amazing. Even, we know the monks, Patimokkha, yesterday, and we were advised, and for the sake of harmony, I thought it was a very good idea, I agreed, to do the Aditana by ourselves. But I come from like the Thai tradition, and our Upasatha was actually yesterday, not the day before. So it was on Friday. You know, just people do the moon differently, it doesn't really matter. So I decided I'll do my Upasatha yesterday. So very busy, as usual, a little bit tired. So when I came here for the Q&A last night, I thought, oh my goodness, I haven't done the Aditana yet. So just at the beginning, when we do the meditation, I practice what I preach. I told myself, Ajahn Brahm, this evening when you go back to your hut, your room, do the Aditana. This evening do the Aditana. This evening do the Aditana. And you know, I tell you, I give everything I've got to what I'm doing. So I'm giving everything I've got to the meditation, everything I've got to the Q&A. I'm still a little bit jet lagged, 2.5 hour difference. So when I went back to my hut, I was tired. So I went to the toilet before going to bed. And as soon as I went to the toilet, Ajahn Brahm, you must do the Upasatha this evening. The memory came up when I was on the toilet. That's just exactly what it's supposed to do. It reminds you, and it comes up exactly the convenient time. Well, actually not so convenient, but do it 5 minutes later. So I did not do the Aditana on the toilet, monks. I'm much more respectful than that. But it's amazing just how your mind can store information and keep it with so little effort at all. So much of those teachings which I heard years and years and years before, when I got to a stage of meditation in my practice, when I really needed that, it just popped up. I thought, wow, that's Ajahn Chah. He's still teaching me after all those years. It's lodged in my mind like a seed waiting for the rain. And when the rain comes, that seed, which I thought had died, bursts into life and teaches me. The mind is incredible how it works. So, there you are, seeing all these things vanish. And when they vanish, it's like a kick up the backside, using a Western expression. Turns you upside down, so you see things, you have to admit it, you're not going crazy. It's impossible, but it was true. The TV set vanished. The lake disappeared. Now you know what Anicca really is. Shocking. Not what you expected. You can read that. You can hear monks explain it. But it's nothing like when it happens. Afterwards, it's like you have to totally reassess how you view the world and nature and existence. You've had amazing experience, data, which overthrows so many of your assumptions. I call them assumptions, the Buddha calls them wrong views. Understandable. Natural, because we have limited experience of the nature of life, of the mind especially, and how it vanishes. That is Anicca. It is there in the suttas. Just like I mentioned the Aggiwacha Gotta Sutta, where the Buddha called it like the flame of an oil lamp. That's your hold of your body and mind. Nothing outside of that flame. No exceptions, no little part which doesn't become extinguished when the causes, the oil, the wick and the heat are taken away. There's nothing left. Just like one of Ajahn, I've only got to Anicca, I've got another talk this afternoon to do the Wiraga and the Wiraga Niroda and Anatta. Well, it's actually a bit of Niroda as well here. So we're in the frame. It Nirodas. There's nothing left. It was there one moment. It's gone the next. It's the nature to totally disappear and vanish. And when people say, but Ajahn Brahm, that is annihilationism. It is not annihilationism. To be annihilated, you need something there first, which is destroyed. And of course the answer is, there's nothing there to begin with. And there is nothing there afterwards. I was a theoretical physicist before I became a monk. And I always like introducing a little bit of physics for you. How similar that is to the Dhamma. People keep asking about where this universe come from. No, just the Rupa Kanda. Forget about the other stuff for the time being. Stuff. Rocks, planets, galaxies, even space. Where did that come from? Because there is a basic law of physics, a basic one, which I'm sure you can all remember from school, that mass energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It just gets changed from one form to another. But it cannot be destroyed, annihilated, nor can it be created. So, how come we've got a universe here? And it's pretty obvious there is a universe. There is stuff. I'm sitting on a chair. This is pretty real. So, how can it all exist? And the answer is, I suggested, it's incredible how being a Buddhist monk, you can get these amazing ideas, even in science. I suggested this years ago. When I was giving a presentation at a local university with a local professor of physics, Professor David Blair, at physics and Buddhism. And especially because I had an advantage. Because I was a Buddhist, but I also knew physics. He was a physicist, but knew nothing about Buddhism. So he was disadvantaged. But nevertheless, on the answer to the question of the origin of this universe, I told him, I said, I know from my theoretical physics background that mass energy has to be conserved. You can't create it or destroy it. But I also know from just my knowledge of theoretical physics, there is something called negative energy. And an example of that, so you can understand it, those of you who remember high school physics. If you take any massive object, just this saucer, to throw this saucer out of the gravitational field of planet Earth needs a lot of energy. And that energy which is needed to free it from a field of energy is a negative energy component. Imagine if the energy needed to throw this out of the gravitational field was exactly the same as the mass energy of this saucer. So to take it from here, the surface of the Earth, out to space, you take all the energy which is actually got in its mass. It would vanish when it got out of the gravitational field. It's negative energy. And I remember very vividly turning to the Professor Blair and said, what would happen, Professor, if we found out that all of the positive energy in this universe, the mass, is totally balanced by the amount of negative energy? It's nothing to do with dark energy, that's a totally different subject. By the negative energy in this universe, if the sum total was zero. And that's what I remember Professor Blair turned to me and say, wow, You are so up to date. Omega, he said, equals one. And I never knew what Omega was. This was since I left. But Omega is actually the ratio of positive to this negative energy in the universe. It balances. So if we can imagine every galaxy, every solar system in every galaxy, every planet, everything just coming together, poof, it will disappear into nothing. No explosion, which is excess energy. It would all come back, poof, and vanish. The Rupa Kanda in this universe, according to the most modern of physics, is a zero sum. There's nothing here. Just divided and becomes life as we know it. But the reality is nothing here. How similar that is to our other khandhas, to the mind. Zero sum. It all comes together. One pointedness. Poof. It vanishes. That's a lovely way of talking about Nirodha. Finishes, ceases. And the last story, before I go, one of my favorite Ajahn Chah stories. I always say I've got two favorites. There's one I haven't told yet, but you've heard it before, I'm sure. But my favorite story was that when I was staying with my teacher, when he started getting sick, we decided to build a sauna for him. Like a hot room, steam room. And for those of you who studied the Vinaya, you know that this is traditional. In the time of the Buddha, monasteries had saunas. So I know that people in Europe think that the Swedish invented saunas. I'm sorry, the Buddha was there a long, many centuries before you invented them. So it was traditional. I don't know why people have saunas. It's hot enough already. Cool rooms I'll go for, but not saunas. So in Australia, we don't have a sauna. And some monks have said, oh, we want to go in a sauna. And they said, just go up in the ceiling, above the ceiling, underneath the steel roof. That'll be your sauna. Do you want to sweat? Do some work if you want to get some sweating. But anyway, so we built a sauna for our master Ajahn Chah. And it had two reasons for that. Half of it was a service to your teacher, which is an important thing to do. But the other half, it was maybe even more, 60%, was personal. So we could get the teacher to come. Every week he would come for his sauna, but it just gave us a chance to hang out with the great master, and he would always give a talk. So that was the main reason, to get him to give a talk. Anything to grab him and give us a special talk. And honestly, being with a teacher in those days, that sometimes you give a talk for hours, and most of it, with great respect to my master, was gomayang. Honestly, it was just boring, useless stuff. But it was worth it, because every now and again he'd say something just incredibly profound. And that was worth 4 or 5 hours of sitting through. And those of you who read books by people like Ajahn Chah, it's the jewels, the diamonds, you know, in the mud. That's what you get. I had to go through all the mud, you know, to get a little jewel. But it was worth it. So you just get the best, the creme de la creme, if you read books like that. But it was worth it. And some days, just like any teacher, sometimes you hit the spot. And sometimes it doesn't work that well. So I'm sure that some of my talks, wow, that was really great. Other ones, do I have to hear that one again? But that's normal, that's natural. So but on this one occasion, Ajahn Chah just really gave a rip snorter, is what we say in the West. An incredible, amazing, brilliant talk. He was really on his game. And afterwards, instead of doing my duties of, you know, helping him with his sauna, doing all of the washing for him, instead of doing that, I thought, no, there are other monks today. I went behind the Dhamma hall, a nice quiet place, crossed my legs and sat meditation. And my goodness, if you have inspiration like that, whoa, your meditation is so deep. It's driven by the superpower of inspiration. If ever you get inspired by any talk, don't waste it. Cross your legs, find a quiet place and just meditate. You'll go so deep. And that was amazing meditation which I had. A couple of hours, I reckon. And then afterwards you come out feeling like $1 million. Actually, no, $1 million is not worth anything these days. $1 billion. And you come out, no, €1 billion. €1 billion's worth more than $1, isn't it? But you feel absolutely great. And the first thought which came up, let's do a duty from my teacher. Maybe there's still time. So I walked towards the dining hall. I was too late. Because I saw him, he was coming towards me. On a path we'd have to cross. And he was with two other Thai people. And as I came closer, you could feel him looking at me. And people can read minds. And for once in my monastic life, I was so happy to have my mind read. Just come out of a beautiful meditation, no defilements, no hindrances. I was actually quite proud of my mind. Take a look, you take a look, anyone could take a look. And honestly, again, it's amazing the experiences you have. You could actually feel your master inside your mind. You can feel that. You know? And I was happy. I'm not going to chase him out. Come, have a look. Have a look here. Have a look there. You know, like you may lay people get a new house and they take people around how clean and tidy it is. They're very proud of it. They get a new monastery. Dayak has come to see where the money's been spent. You take them here, take them there. You're very proud. That's like my mind. So having allowed Ajahn Chah to tour my mind, then he went out and then he looked at me. And great, well, I can't do this. You can't imitate other people. You have to just, you know, be your own underlying qualities. He just looked at me with just real fierceness, but kindness at the same time. So he weren't afraid, but he was really, this is serious. So that's when Ajahn Chah looked at me. And he said, Bama Wangso. Quite fierce, but not scary. Bama Wangso. Why? That's what he said in Thai. Tamai. Why? And I paused for a while. And I answered, I don't know. What a stupid answer. When a great master is trying to enlighten you. You've got all your five hindrances all gone. And then he tries his very best to get you to look a bit deeper. And all I said, I don't know. He felt so stupid in his presence. But the great masters, they never scold you and say, why am I teaching a dummy like this? I expected more from you if you came from Cambridge, you idiot. He never says something like that. He just laughs. The stupidity of monks is a cause for great laughter to Arius. And I caused him much laughter. All the idiotic things I did. I entertained my teacher with stupidity. So he was always laughing. So never scolding, but laughing. And then, finishing laughing, then he looked at me again and screwed up his face. Bama Wangso. Yes. I will tell you the answer. And at that I got really excited. This great master was giving a personal, only to me, no one else, a personal teaching, some of the deepest of Dhammas. The answer to the question, why? From a great master. And I was listening with everything I've got. And he said the answer to the question why is, there's nothing. There's nothing. In Thai, my, me, or I. Not is anything. There's nothing it means. My, me, or I. There's nothing. And he looked at me with so much compassion. And he said, do you understand? Do you understand? And I said, yes. He said, no, you don't. And he walked away. And I felt so terrible. All that bliss of the meditation totally vanished. But I always remembered that. What a great answer that is. A quick question. No, why? There's nothing. That's how we can get to emptiness. Nothing. Disappearance. Vanishing. No odour. There's nothing. There's nothing here. That's why it can cease. Nothing's getting destroyed. There's nothing here to begin with. Do you understand? No, you don't. Okay, enough for today. Or this morning anyway.